We're pleased to be joined by Judge Chad Radler, who has served on the Sixth Circuit of Appeals since March of 2019. He earned his undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Michigan, and after graduating, he served as a law clerk to Judge Alan Norris of the United States Court of Appeals of the Sixth Circuit. Judge Radler then began practicing law in the Columbus office of Jones Day, eventually spending 10 years as a partner in the firm's issues and appeals practice group. Following his career in private practice, he served as acting assistant attorney general for the Civil Division of the United States Department of Justice from 2017 to 2019, and he resides in Columbus, Ohio. So he's going to be the moderator, and he's going to introduce the rest of the panel. Thank you again for coming.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It is so nice to be here and to be up here. Let me say for two reasons. One, of course, we couldn't be together in person last year, so it's great to see everybody. Glad we can enjoy programming and fellowship in the hallway and at dinner. Also, I've been probably coming to these symposium, these seminars for about 20 years, and this is the first chance I've had to be on a podium and speak here at the National Convention, so I'm really honored. I remember when the dinner was in this room, not at a big at a Union Station or a fancy hotel. The stage was up there. The table I sat at was way back there, probably behind those curtains. But I will say there's a lot of, I see younger lawyers in the crowd, and so we hope to see all of you up here someday as well as a panelist or a moderator. So we have a really terrific program today about the current and future of antitrust law. Unfortunately, Macon Delrahim he was scheduled to be here and due to a family medical issue, couldn't join us. So we have four terrific panelists. I'm confident we will fill all the time. And it's my main job to introduce them, which I'm going to do now. I'm going to introduce them in the order that they're speaking, where the order is from my right to left. So I'm going to start with Judge Ginsburg, but I have to say, I probably would have started with Judge Ginsburg either way. He's someone I've really admired for many years, even long before I was a judge. And so not only is it a privilege to be up here, it's a real privilege to introduce him. Judge Ginsburg is a senior judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and a professor at law at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. He serves as chairman of the International Advisory Board of the Scalia Law's Global Antitrust Institute, and served previously as Assistant Attorney General for the DOJ's Antitrust Division. He authored and co-authored several books and more than 100 articles on competition and regulation. And one thing that's not in the official bio I was given, but many of you probably know, is that Judge Ginsburg is also a TV star. And he's too modest to admit that, but he has been the star of a three-part series programs featured on PBS about the U.S. Constitution. And those have been shown now, I think, across the country, across PBS, to many schools. Many other people have seen the show. And I have anecdotal evidence, actually, that you are a star and that you're reaching a wide audience. I was at my daughter's high school tennis match this fall, and a friend of mine walked up, and he's not a lawyer, but he's publicly minded, and so we started talking. And he said, "You know, Judge, can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." And I'm thinking, you know, he's probably going to ask me about that opinion I just wrote. That was one of my better ones. I'm really excited about that. Well, I thought maybe he'll ask me about the dissenting opinion I wrote a few months ago, because that was a pretty good one, too. And he says, "Judge, do you know Judge Ginsburg in D.C.?" And I said, "I do." And he said, "Well, I just saw his series on PBS. It was wonderful. He must be a wonderful judge." And I assured him that he is, but this just proves the reach of your programming has gone well beyond just legal audiences and students. Next is the Honorable William Baer. Bill Baer is a visiting fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He recently volunteered for the Biden administration, and he has previously served as Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Antitrust Division at the U.S. Department of Justice from 2013 to 2016, and as Director of the Bureau of Competition at the Federal Trade Commission from 1995 to 1999. A Stanford Law School graduate, Mr. Baer works now focuses on antitrust and competition policy. Ms. Diana Moss. Diana Moss became the president of the American Antitrust Institute in January 2015. An economist, Dr. Moss has developed and expanded the Institute's advocacy channels and strategies and strengthened communications with enforcers, Congress, and other advocacy groups and the media. Her work spans both antitrust and regulation with industry expertise in digital technology, electricity, petroleum, food and agriculture, airlines, telecommunications, and healthcare. Before joining the Institute in 2001, Dr. Moss was at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And next is Mr. François-Henri Boyard, who I think had the longest trip to get here, coming all the way from Paris, so thank you very much. François-Henri Boyard is a partner and Supreme Court attorney at Cabinet Boyard, a law firm in Paris, France. Mr. Boyard is a Knight of the Legion of Honor and an officer of the National Order of Merit. He was a member of the governing board of the bar of the French Supreme Court and a trustee of Sarah Lawrence College in New York. He is president of the Institute Varennes, which I understand he co-founded with Justice Scalia, a member of the U.S. Supreme Court Historical Society, and an honorary member of the Society of the Cincinnati and of the Sons of the American Revolution. And it says, real privilege to have you here. I haven't polled all of our panelists, but I suspect if you'd like to have us to Paris to do the same thing, in the future, we'd be more than happy to do it. So our speakers are gonna start with maybe 5 to 10 minutes here at the podium with opening remarks, and then we'll have some back and forth. I'll have a few questions, but of course, being a Federal Society event, we'll hope to hear from you with some questions near the end of the program. So with that, I think Judge Ginsburg, you're gonna start us off.
Thank you, Chair. Let me know when I'm getting running out of time. Okay. Thank you for the pitch for the program. So I think my remit here is to give a little background as to how we got to the consumer welfare standard, which has been so much discussed in the last couple of years by people who would like to change that standard that's been guiding our two antitrust agencies since at least 1981. From the period 1890 when the Sherman Act was passed until roughly almost the end of the 70s. I think it was fair to say, and I have said elsewhere and documented, that the state of antitrust law was one of incoherence, inconsistency, economic nonsense, and altogether disreputable. The probability is that over the period of from 1890 until the late 1970s, antitrust law had done more harm than good for the economy. To take examples, there were cases in which it was held to violate the Sherman Act for a large national company coming into Salt Lake City to underprice the local bakery. Cases in which it was held unlawful for small grocery chains to merge. In Los Angeles, there were two grocery chains, each with about 30 stores, I guess a little more because the total was, I think, 70 or 75. And they were about equal size. They were in a market in which there were 5,132 grocery stores. And that merger was held unlawful on the ground that it would tend to create a monopoly. And the idea was that the antitrust laws have then amended and still are, were meant to halt any trend toward concentration, quote, in its incipiency, close quote. So decisions like this, and these were all Supreme Court decisions, were really indefensible in any economically sensible way. But things started to change, first in the academy. in economics departments in particular. Industrial organization economics, during the era when the Supreme Court was approving prohibitions against mergers of relatively small firms, was not inconsistent with that. I mean, the learning at the time did tend to support what the courts were doing, but that learning had been undermined, starting really in the late 50s, but primarily and conclusively in the 60s when the court was making all these decisions. It became quite obvious that simply because there's a merger that increases, that therefore by definition is going to increase concentration if the two firms are in the same market, that really is not likely to have any adverse effect on consumers or anyone else, and is likely to confer some advantages. If the people are seeking to merge, they expect to realize some economies. Those in a competitive market, like the Los Angeles grocery market, those economies will be passed along to consumers in the form of lower prices. By the mid-70s, it was really quite clear that industrial organization economics, that the world had changed, that concentration below a very significant level is unlikely to have any adverse effect. In 1977, the Supreme Court decided an extraordinarily important case in the sense that it was a harbinger of so much of what was to come. Continental TV against Sylvania, a case involving a vertical restraint in which the manufacturer Sylvania, by his contract with the retailer, allowed it to sell televisions only at a specific address. When Sylvania started to sell TVs through another dealer not too far away, such that Continental was feeling the effects, they simply opened another store. They were in San Francisco. They opened one in Sacramento without contractual authorization. There was a series of events that led to terminating them as a dealer. They sued, and it went to the Supreme Court. And the court applied a quite rational economic analysis. Justice White, in his concurring opinion, that the court said, well, these non-price restraints, they're okay. You know, these geographical restraints, customer allocations, because they may be helpful, they may be efficient in some cases. They should no longer be deemed per se unlawful, as all vertical restraints had been. And it was Justice White in his concurrence who said, there's no principled way to distinguish price and non-price vertical restraints. And of course he was right. It was clear in the literature. That was 1977. The court proceeded to overrule four cases. Finally, in 2007, they got rid of the last per se condemnation, which was for setting a retail minimum price. It took 40 years. Unfortunately, Justice White did not live to see his complete vindication. In 1978, Robert Bork brought out his book, The Antitrust Paradox, documenting in detail the economic errors that were being made in the case law and setting out a framework that would discipline the decision making in antitrust cases in a way that just wasn't done before. That was 1978. Now the book had been largely written by, I think, 1973, but Professor Bork was in government service and his wife was ill, and he didn't get back to finishing it until then. It came out in 78. By the way, the book went out of print for some years, and a new edition has been brought out by Robert Bork Jr., whom I see here in the audience, and it is available anywhere books are sold, anywhere good books are sold, with some additional materials that have been added. So I strongly recommend that if you're interested in the topic at all, that you read this foundational book. But Bork's thesis was that the antitrust laws had been intended, the Sherman Act was intended as a consumer welfare statute. Now, that's highly contestable. There are lots of theories about what the legislative history shows. It's a mess. And I wrote an article about this. There are three separate hypotheses or theses about what it represents, what it tells us. In a circumstance like that, I think the short answer is it tells you nothing if it can be looked at by three different, completely different perspectives. But Bob said it's a consumer welfare statute, and that's 1978. And in 1979, the Supreme Court decides a case, Ryder against Sonatone, and it says the Sherman Act is a consumer welfare statute. See Robert Bork, The Antitrust Paradox. An extraordinary accomplishment in terms of this book making its way into Supreme Court doctrine in a year and completely reorienting the doctrine ever since then. In 1981, when the new administration came in, Professor Bill Baxter became the new head of the Antitrust Division. James Miller, another academic, PhD economist, first economist to chair, maybe the only economist still to chair the Federal Trade Commission, came in, followed by shortly thereafter by Dan Oliver, who was here also as chairman. And the department and the commission began to revise their enforcement program in a very clear, consistent way, following the consumer welfare standard. That is still the reigning position of the agencies. It is the law, as the Supreme Court has given it to us, and there are innumerable lower court decisions applying it. Now, recent criticism has said, well, it's too narrow. You shouldn't think of it just as a consumer welfare statute. Other values should be incorporated into the analysis. And those values range from wage considerations, employment, let me put it that way, jobs. Is a merger going to eliminate a lot of jobs? Well, from an economic point of view, that's a good thing. Right, it means that the company is going to use fewer resources, or the merged company will use fewer resources to produce its output. But from a political point of view, of course, that's something bemoaned by the local congressman. All other values have been suggested. Believe it or not, income inequality. What could be done through the antitrust laws about income inequality? About the environment. There's no end to the creativity with which people can think of other things that should be brought into the analysis besides the welfare of consumers. If any of those were to succeed and be taken seriously, I think it would create a situation in which it would tend toward arbitrary decision making, because how can one trade off so much in consumer welfare gain against so much in job loss or income inequality? They're incommensurable. And some economists could tell you that they can do it, but the fact is it will either be or will no doubt appear to be entirely arbitrary decision making. It would politicize the process and the perception, and erase a great deal of progress that has been made. So that's my brief defense of the consumer welfare standard. It took us out of the chaos and created a system of a coherent, consistent, reasoned application that involves great attention to the actual economic consequences of antitrust decisions. Chad, if that's enough, I will excuse myself. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Baer, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to be on such a distinguished panel and to appear before the Federalist Society. This is obviously a timely topic. We antitrust nerds discuss these issues all the time, but today's conversation about competition, about the adequacy of our current approach to competition policy, really has gone mainstream. You know, much of the discussion focuses on the dominant role that four big successful tech companies play in our daily lives, but the debate and the concerns being expressed are, I think it's fair to say, are broader than that. Concerns about increasing concentration in markets of varying sizes and shapes. Renewed interest in the duties of a dominant firm to deal with others. Concern with the behavior of those with intellectual property rights that have become standard essential. Questions are being asked about whether the current application of the consumer welfare standard, just as Judge Ginsburg just talked about, does it leave the way it's being applied too much consumer injury on the table? And there are questions as to whether or not recent Supreme Court decisions, a lot of focus is being paid on the American Express opinion dealing with two-sided platforms, whether it puts too much of a burden on the government to prove harms, and that also contributes to leaving consumer injury unaddressed. Huge discussion on Capitol Hill, I'm sure you are aware of it, and it does seem to reflect increasingly a bipartisan concern that that there are problems with the current state of U.S. competition policy, if not bipartisan agreement on what needs to be done about it, if anything. I understand the defense that Judge Ginsburg just put forward of the consumer welfare standard and the importance it had in shaping antitrust policy over the last 40 years. And there's a lot to be said in support of getting some sort of analytical framework in place that offered predictability to consumers, to business, to the courts. Some of the jurisprudence, as Judge Ginsburg said, out of the 50s and 60s, just couldn't be rationalized with each other. You know, there's that famous Justice Potter Stewart quip in the 1966 Fonda's Grocery case that the sole consistency I can find in litigation under Section 7 of the Clayton Act is that the government always wins. Applying a consumer welfare standard to antitrust decision-making and holding government and private plaintiffs to a demanding level of proof did offer a certain consistency and predictability, and it avoided those type one errors of over-enforcement. But the question being asked, not the only question, but a question being asked in our public discourse is, have we overshot the mark? Many of you may know of the venerable IO economist Carl Shapiro. He recently presented a paper that challenged a number of what he called the pro-defendant doctrinal assumptions that he believes that are unsupported by current industrial organization economics. He thinks the assumption that predatory pricing is rarely profitable and therefore justifies a legal standard that makes proving predatory behavior close to impossible, he thinks that's not supported by current evidence. He thinks statements to the effect that vertical mergers are inevitably a means of creating efficiency, not of injuring competition, is, again, not supported by up-to-date research about the ability in a vertical transaction or through a vertical restriction to raise rivals' costs and limit competition. The assumption in some of the people who advocate for the consumer welfare standard that monopolies do not last over time and are not a real worry. The challenge by some who support the consumer welfare standard that the Philadelphia National Bank Supreme Court decision, which set up a structural presumption in horizontal mergers, that at a certain size, it's a transaction is presumed anti-competitive. There's been a lot of challenge to that. I think the latest research coming out of the industrial organization economics academics suggests there may actually be something to that. And a challenge that you do see with the tech platforms, the current consumer welfare standard doesn't seem to reach what I call Pac-Man acquisitions by dominant firms, right? The notion that you can gobble up a nascent competitor, any number of them, but the current law on potential competition doesn't seem to reach that. So these are just some of the concerns that are causing many to think we ought to rethink the consumer welfare standard at least as currently applied by the courts. Now, some want to abandon it completely. They see it as misnamed because it effectively focuses on shareholder welfare and just assumes markets are almost always competitive and invariably M&A activity or exclusive conduct by a dominant firm will create efficiencies which will trickle down to consumers. Those critics want antitrust enforcement to find a way to attack not just economic, but social injustice, some of those critics of the consumer welfare standard. Others see it as a workable standard, but as currently applied, focuses too much on price effects, too little on product quality improvements and innovation, that it ignores any competitive intent, fails to adequately focus on monopsony power, and tilts way too heavily towards avoiding type 1 errors of over-enforcement. I tend to put myself in this second group. We have lots of challenges today in our society that need to be addressed, but not sure that antitrust policy is the best way to address all or most of them, unless you can tie the injustices we're concerned about to some form of economic injustice. A good example would be non-competes imposed on fast food workers. You know, that's an exercise of coordinated monopsony power that does have a wage-suppressing effect, an effect on the ability to move from company to company. And that's the sort of thing where pursuing economic justice for workers and attacking monopsony power is, I think, consistent with an appropriate view of the consumer welfare standard. So, look, we've got two options about how to go the way I think we ought to go. Track one would be bringing more cases in an effort to shift the court's thinking to embrace a broader view of what constitutes antitrust injury and to be less worried about the occasional type 1 error of over-enforcement. Because you have to have the needle somewhere, and it's going to skew one way or the other. And if your focus is worrying about over-enforcement, you may well be, in fact, promoting under-enforcement. So those cases can and should be brought. If you look at the recent actions by the FTC against Facebook, by DOJ against Google, they attempt to attack some of these issues. The Facebook case focusing on the Pac-Man acquisitions, the Google case focusing on restrictions by a dominant firm that arguably limit the ability of rivals to enter and effectively to compete. So that is one way of going, but candidly, if you are worried about antitrust injury that's not being properly addressed, it's going to take a long time to get the courts to move towards what I view as a more centrist position with regard to antitrust injury. You look at the Google case, it was brought 13 months ago. It's not scheduled to go to trial until the earliest 2023. Obviously, there are going to be appeals. Whichever side wins, whichever side loses. So we don't know how long it's going to take to get from here to there. The Facebook case, you know, has some problems with it, too, in terms of trying to get our jurisprudence better aligned with attacking antitrust and consumer injury. That case challenges the acquisition of two small companies, Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp in 2014. It's going to take forever and a day to get those cases, that case adjudicated. And then what's the relief going to be when you get down the road? Wouldn't it have been better if the ability of the antitrust authorities to go after nascent acquisitions were embraced by the courts? So I don't know that relying solely on the courts to slowly adjust their thinking is the only way to go or is a direction that necessarily will produce the positive results for which I'm advocating. And that explains why in Congress many, in fact, on both sides of the aisle are talking about legislation that updates our view on what the antitrust laws mean, how they should be applied. And there does seem to be mainstream support for adopting or tweaking, really, the antitrust statutes to redirect the courts and redirect the enforcement agencies towards a more assertive and less cautious approach. Now, you know, the notion that we could get bipartisan consensus on anything in this Congress has an oxymoronic quality to it. I think it's fair to say. But it is interesting to see that in this one area, I think for many different reasons, people seem to think something needs to be done, that changes need to be made. As I've said, I think they can be very modest changes to the language of the Sherman and the Clayton Acts, and shifting some burden to defendants in certain circumstances, for example, a dominant firm acquiring somebody in its market space, to have the burden on them to demonstrate that this is not anti-competitive, is not a dramatic shift in the way our antitrust laws are applied, but it would allow the government to go after more M&A activity that poses risks. And the Clayton Act, frankly, talks about risks and tendencies, not certainties. There are other problems, as I said, out there in society that need to be addressed. There are problems caused by externalities resulting from competition today. You look at the tech platforms and privacy concerns. Those issues need to be addressed, too. But again, I'm not sure antitrust is the best vehicle with which to address those sorts of public policy concerns. So, bottom line for me, we need to move towards a more assertive competition policy, whether through the courts or the courts with a big or decent-sized nudge from the Congress. Thank you, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you. I think I'm on here. Am I on?
I think so.
Microphone on? Yes. Thank you. I've taken a look at the angle on this podium, and I'm pretty sure my computer would zing right off of there. So I am going to speak from here, if that's okay. It's a pleasure to be here at the Federalist Society. Thank you, Judge Riedler, for moderating, and it's really an honor to be here with my esteemed colleagues. I want to talk about a number of key issues, I think, in the debate over antitrust reform and where we are in antitrust. This panel has a question mark at the end of the title, the antitrust revolution, and that could signal some skepticism, perhaps, about whether the substance and the enforcement of our laws are adequate. But it could also signal good questions about what a revolution should look like. What are the goals? What are the policy tools for enhancing and promoting competition? I think it's always worth reminding everyone that we live in the greatest market-based economy in the world. And market-based economies are supported by democratic principles. And the purpose of antitrust enforcement and competition policy is to make sure that the playing field is level. And antitrust is really the referee, ensuring, calling balls and strikes, ensuring that the game is played by the rules. This protects the competitive process, and it really should be, and it seems like it should be, a priority public policy goal. So competition is, in fact, a public policy problem, and concerns over declining competition are a public policy problem. But it's a toolkit problem, right? We have all sorts of tools available to us, antitrust enforcement, we have sector regulation, we have intellectual property law, labor law, trade law, standards. We have all sorts of tools available. And I remain somewhat concerned that under the current approach, we are not really plowing the depths of that toolkit approach. So the conundrum is that the U.S. remains the leader in global innovation, Economist recently put out a really interesting article. We are still outpacing China in terms of innovation. The U.S. is also fueled largely by small business creation, right? So we have that good stuff going on, but we also have economic and business research that's showing that competition is in decline. We have some rising concentration concerns. We have lower rates of wage and benefits growth. We have rising margins. And there's a skew in the distribution of wealth to the top tier of corporations and the top tier of individuals. These seemingly conflicting factoids absolutely can coexist. The U.S. can continue to be a powerhouse in innovation and small business generation, but we can also have parallel concerns about market power and rising concentration. They don't cancel each other out necessarily because they deal with fundamentally different macroeconomic and microeconomic phenomenon. So where are we today? Well, I would say we're in a bit of disarray. There is some ideological aversion to over-enforcement. You just heard Bill Baer comment on that. That is a tired and worn out argument, and it is really the primary reason, I think, for declining competition. It really puts consumers and workers and small businesses at the mercy of dominant firms and oligopolies, and it quashes small business growth, which is really part of the engine of the U.S. economy. And so risk aversion for probably four decades now has really hamstrung antitrust enforcement. There's reluctance to challenge potentially harmful mergers, driven by something called error cost analysis or giving too much weight to the risk of stifling pro-competitive deals. And the government, rightly so in many cases, has a lot of litigation risk aversion. They don't want to go to court and get slapped down in court. They have limited resources. They want to really maintain good track records of winning in court. But at the same time, the government has this litigation risk aversion because they face almost insurmountable standards of proof to show harmful effects of mergers. And also in Section 2 cases, in monopolization cases, possession of monopoly power, leveraging of market power, and harm to consumers. The standards have risen to the point where it is almost impossible to get a good result on a Section 2 case. Good for consumers, good for competition. I would also echo some of Bill's comments about the debate over the consumer welfare standard. The consumer welfare standard, technically, I'm an economist, should be adequate. It should be adequate for the purpose that it's designed for, if it's properly interpreted. So the consumer welfare standard, if properly interpreted by the courts, can get at competitive harms anywhere in a supply chain, right? There doesn't have to always be an effect on the end-use consumer. Workers can be harmed. We can see competitive harm in input markets. We don't necessarily just look at price effects either under the consumer welfare standards. We can also look at quality effects or non-price dimensions of competition. The standard also looks at short-term efficiencies, cost savings, right? But it can also look at longer-term dynamic benefits from quality improvements, products faster to market, innovation, et cetera. And so the standard actually does account for equity concerns, distribution of wealth, and it accounts for efficiency concerns. It looks at buyer power, and it looks at seller market power. So again, the problem with the standard is that it has been interpreted in a very cramped, constrained way by the courts for many years. But we've seen glimmers. We've seen some key cases, the private chicken cases right now, price-fixing cases in the courts. 2009 case involving JBS National beef packing, absolutely defined an upstream market for fed cattle. So, but it's not enough. It's not enough. We've had 40 years of a very cramped interpretation. All right, so where are we now? I think we should construct or rest our recommendations on an evidence-based case. That's what we all do in antitrust. We look at evidence. Policy prescriptions can be better defended and leveraged off of evidence. The rate at which challenge mergers are being settled is rising faster than the rate at which the agencies are actually going to federal court to seek injunctions. So that's not a good trend. Section 2 enforcement is at an impasse because of the high standards I talked about earlier. Section 1, private enforcement cases are a bit in disarray because the standards for showing collusion are now astronomically high, even when there is evidence of reaching and maintaining an agreement. Perhaps even worse, declining competition, rising concentration is creating a lot of fear of retaliation. And so small businesses, consumers, are reluctant to come forward to testify with evidence. And we have no antitrust enforcement unless we can bring in the third party evidence to talk about potential violations. We also have a host of sort of new challenges that enforcers are still grappling with. Things like the ecosystem mergers that we see in the digital business ecosystems, acquisitions of nascent rivals. Growth through acquisition. We know the digital tech platforms grow through acquisition as opposed to organically. We see a lot of vertical integration now. And in healthcare, for example, CVS Aetna, in telecoms, AT&T, Time Warner. And the paradigm in competition is shifted now to competition between these behemoth platforms, right? And when you only have two or three of them, is that enough? Is that enough to get good competition when you have two or three vertically integrated platforms in a sector? We also have rising concerns with algorithmic collusion, using algorithms in the digital ecosystems to self-preference, to steer users around, and discriminate against rivals. So these are all new challenges that enforcers may not be very well equipped to do. On the legislative front, I think we see disarray. Congress only has so much bandwidth for talking about reform. We have two different divergent paths on reform, Amy Klobuchar's more comprehensive bills to strengthen and clarify and modernize, and then this set of bills coming out of the House and actually now in the Senate, which targets not just a specific sector, but it targets specific companies in the sector, in the digital tech sector. All right, so everyone who cares about markets and democracy and all that good stuff should really support constructive, coherent reform that promotes stronger enforcement and gives enforcers in the courts the tools to be able to get at some of our modern problems. Unfortunately, the alternatives that we've been hearing about may not be that workable. For example, making the goal a public interest standard. Well, we have sector regulators that do that. Working in ESG and environmental social governance factors, these all raise questions and concerns about weighing very indirect effects against more direct effects in looking at antitrust concerns. So the agencies, finally to wrap up, the agencies can do a lot. If Congress can't get it together ultimately with constructive reform, the agencies can actually do a lot. We need some good vertical merger guidelines. We need to take another look at HSR reporting requirements. We need to think about what constitutes direct evidence of market power, which makes it easier to make some cases. We absolutely need to take a look at the role of private equity and partial ownership acquisitions and what that means. And we need to think about things like, is it okay to approve divestitures of assets, say in merger cases, to known cartelists? It happens all the time. Divestitures to known cartelists in merger cases. And on top of all that, we need continued support for state enforcement, and we need to protect and nurture that public-private partnership between private enforcers and public enforcers, which is sometimes a tenuous line in the United States. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Judge Redler, dear colleagues, dear Douglas Ginsburg, I should have some slides coming. Okay, fine. For about 25 years, exactly 23, I had a wonderful friend in this country, Actually, he taught me everything about the U.S., everything about your Constitution. He used to say about me, "François is the only French I'm talking to." You can see him. His name was Antonin Scalia, and I miss him very much, as you do. So I'm the Frenchman, and I'm here with my compatriots. I have 10 of my compatriots who are here. You can raise your hands, okay? And I have two elected people, Paul Hatt, who is a Paris councillor, and also Senator de Montgolfier, who came from the French Senate to see you tonight. So I'm very honored to provide today a short point of view from the European perspective. And thank you to the Federalist Society for sharing that point of view on this panel. And I propose to you to travel to EU for some minutes, and I'd like to address 4 points about Europe in antitrust world. Where does it come from? What does it mean? How does it work? And what about US companies in Europe? I know that's an issue. So these are the question I'd like to address very quickly. Where does it come from? Where does it come from? You know, Commissioner Vestager, who is our Lenecan, she likes to say that competition law was born in Rome 2,000 years ago, which is true, actually. But EU rules were born, as you know, right after World War II, when Churchill called for a United States of Europe. And through every stage of the construction of what we know as the EU, the 27 state members, I remind you that it represents 450 million consumers market. The founders, and we still keep that in mind, the founders thought that political and social integration of Europe had to be linked with legal and economic integration. This is one of the main idea of our founding fathers, the two Frenchmen, Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman. Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman thought that the only way was the establishment of a single market in Europe, and the proper way to create that market was to protect operators and consumers from unfair competition. These guys, by the way, you can see them, they were pro-American and they were pro-free market, not because they were CIA agents, as some French thought at this time, but because we just shared with the US at this time the same concern about USSR, and we saw the US as protecting our continent. And the rules our founders promoted at this time were actually inspired by U.S. laws. I remind you that Allied forces introduced these laws in Germany in 1957, which was quite fitting with the Ordo Liberalismus from the Freiburg Schule. And to achieve that revolution, to make a compatible, transparent and fairly framework for competition law, we had these treaties, the treaties of Rome and the following rules, 1957, 1962, and some others. And to some extent, these antitrust rules can be compared to your Clayton Act of 1914. In other words, and I think it's important that you keep this in mind, the EU has been built around antitrust rules with an American inspiration at the beginning. Point two, what does this mean? Four main issues. I remind you that antitrust law in Europe is not run by politics, but by law, by European law. Point one, we prohibit agreements between market operators, which restrict competition. We fight what your Supreme Court calls the supreme evil of antitrust, the cartels between competitors, which may involve price fixing, reference prices, prices manipulation, or market sharing. Then, point two, we prohibit abuse of dominant position on a given market by charging unfair prices, limiting production, or refusing to innovate to the prejudice of consumers. Point three, we control mergers and acquisitions to make sure they are compatible with the single market. And four, we have a tool that you do not have in the US, and which I think it's a very good tool to ensure free competition. We do make a control on state aids, on government aids, to make sure that companies do not receive from government or public entities any support to gain an advantage on competitors. And that is a major difference with the US, where I think sometimes the government can support the economy out of the antitrust laws. So limiting power, economic power and concentration, protecting consumers' welfare, we share with you the same goals. It is true that we have a different approach, but the goals are the same. Now, how does this work, the machine, the antitrust European machine? Well, the European Commission is the executive branch of the EU, as you know, and it is responsible for enforcing European antitrust laws, and its main role is to control anti-competitive behaviors. It is our FTC, right? It is a kind of FTC. It is made of one competition commissioner. You can see her, Margaret Vestager, she's from Denmark, and a staff of thousands in Brussels. Processes are heavy and complex, and the Commission has significant investigation powers and may impose, as you know, big fines. The work of the Brussels Commission is shared with local state members, agencies, like in France, in my country, l'autorité de la concurrence. And all these proceedings, it's important, are made, are followed under the control of courts. We have two courts in Luxembourg which review the work made by the European Commission. Last point, what about US companies? I know it's a big concern for you, and it is true that the past years have seen a lot of major fines pronounced by the EU Commission toward American companies. I remind you two of them only, the two fines against Google, 2017, $2.8 billion. And the fine was just confirmed 2 days ago by the Luxembourg court, first instance, and Google will go to the Superior Court. And 2018, $5 billion, and the case is still pending. There are some possible comments on this. Your former president said on Twitter, I quote him, "I told you so. The EU just slapped a $5 billion fine on one of our great companies, Google. They truly have taken advantage on the US, but not for long." End of quote. And the issue, the question is, are these fines a kind of revenge from the Europeans trying to wreck the GAFAM domination? It's a question, and I understand that you raised that question, but and it is true that we do not have, I think, the same idea of, I would say, market leadership that you have here, which is not so popular in Brussels, where we favor potential competitors. But I'd like to convince you today, and that will be my last remark, that we have nothing in Europe against U.S. companies. U.S. companies have a big business in Europe. And I would like you to make sure that, these fines are fair. Why? For three reasons. The first one is that EU antitrust laws are the same for everyone. Everyone, European or U.S. companies. This is exactly what is engraved on your Supreme Court building. Law is the same for everybody, equal under the law. The second reason is that these fines are not always inflicted to American companies. When Mrs. Vestager says, and I quote her, when you get that big, you get a special responsibility because you are the ruler in the sector that you own, end of quote. She speaks about everyone. I say everyone, not only U.S. companies. And as you know, the EU Commission recently blocked a big merger, and it was a merger between two French and German companies, Alstom and Siemens. And actually, the merger was blocked at a time where the Chinese made a huge, giant for train industry, CRRCC, without any problem, but by the way. But that merger was blocked by EU Commission. And finally, I remind you that these fines are reviewed by the Luxembourg Court, and the Luxembourg Court are impartial and independent courts. You can see the ruling from the General Court in 2017 overturning the Commission decision to pay 250 million, it was on a U.S. company, because of illegal state aid from Luxembourg. It's time to conclude. I have four remarks, very quick. The first one is that please keep in mind that we belong to the same family, right? We belong to the same family. This is, Judge Stapper mentioned this morning, Paris bureaucrats. We may have bureaucrats, as you do, but we also have free men. I'm a free man. And we founded together 250 years ago that alliance based on pursuit of happiness and freedom. And regarding antitrust law, we must act together. Point two, we are facing close economic situations on both sides of the pond, right? And your laws may move, but ours may move also in the same direction. We face the same issues. Point three, GAFAM are not the only threat. China is another one, as you know, with very little antitrust regulation and very small control on Chinese concentrations. And this is your problem, but this is also our problem. And five, I end with this, I think that we must cooperate. We must be together. We may have a different approach in antitrust, but as I said, the goals are the same, and we must promote a dialogue between the EU and the US. We must have partnership together. We must protect economic freedom and common good. God bless your country. Vive la France.
Sure. Is this mic working? It is. Okay, good. There was no green light. One thing you learn as being a judge is the difference between green light and red light. But this one didn't seem to be working, but I'm happy to hear that it is. Well, let me first say to the panelists, is there anything that you heard from a co-panelist that you really want to share a response to?
Yes.
I'm not.
Anything more, Doug?
I'll get there. If this thing will work, pressing buttons...
I think it's on.
I think it's working.
Is it on? I think it's on.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm the one with the green light, but I'm red-green colorblind, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and my light didn't go on, but I can see here it's working. So I just want to point out, I want to point out that first that I think virtually everything that Bill said and much of what Diana said concerns a perceived gap between current enforcement policy and court decisions on the one hand and the current state of thinking in the industrial organization economics departments. The course of the last 40 years with the consumer welfare standard has been to incorporate, it's founded initially on incorporating contemporary learning from the economics field, and it's structured and built to do that. And as that learning changes, so too must the court decisions. Carol Shapiro was given as an example, and a very good one, in his work on predatory pricing, among other things. Carol's a frequent expert witness. That learning will come into court, and if it's not utterly controlled by precedent, it will be as persuasive as is justified. So there's nothing peculiar about the consumer welfare standard that rules out new thinking about consumer welfare. Now, Bill expressed some impatience, I guess I would say, with the common law process, saying, the courts are slow and the Congress is fast. making rules for the conduct of business, that is to say, constraining them by new antitrust rules, has a lot of risks involved because there's no rule that's appropriate for every case. It's not possible. And the common law process is, of course, adapted to learn from experience case by case. And I think it has served us well the last 700 years or so, including some competition cases that do go back several hundred years in England. So I would caution one about the risks of legislative solutions. In addition to being inherently overbroad, they are founded on whatever little bit of learning can be brought to bear through hearings and so on the Hill. That can't possibly incorporate the richness of the diversity in this enormous economy. François referred to what Commissioner Vestager has said about dominant firms, that when they become dominant in a market, they have a responsibility, basically, to their rivals. To put it simply, they must handle themselves, their rivals, with kid gloves, not do things that will prejudice them. Well, that is a foreign concept in U.S. law. In our law, if a firm becomes dominant because it has a better product or service, it's quite welcome to continue growing its market share and may become a monopoly if it's got the thing that consumers want more than anything else. In the European Court of Justice, the highest court, a few years ago, maybe 5 years, François, there was the Intel decision. And it's quite amusing. It's about 800 paragraphs long, which is not unusual for that forum. But at paragraph 770, it says something like, it's exactly the same thing that we say in this country, exactly, that the purpose of the competition law is to protect, not to protect firms, but to protect the competitive process. No disagreement on either side, correct? And then a few paragraphs later, it says, but of course, without competitors, there isn't any competitive process, i.e., we have to protect them. And there is this real difference, significant difference in our approaches. Now, as Henri brought out, of course, Our companies are governed by their law when they operate in Europe. And they have been sued on a number of occasions, many times for cases that we would not bring. The FTC investigated a search case, decided there was no case there, but the European Commission brought such a case. The companies have been sued, in terms of the common law process being slow, the companies have been sued in France, in Germany, in the United Kingdom, in the European Commission level, in Australia, in India. I think there are cases in Japan. I'm not positive of that. Japan. The case against Google was filed by the previous administration. It's not as if there isn't enforcement going on. It's true the cases take a long time to be resolved because they're huge cases with enormous amounts of discovery and a great deal at stake, not just for the companies, but for the precedents that will be set. So I think impatience is rather risky and out of place. The process is proceeding all around the world.
Yeah, just a quick response. I don't think you resort to legislative changes lightly, and it really comes to a risk-reward thing. Are we sufficiently concerned about under-enforcement and the consumer harm to competition caused by that we think we need to act now? When I spoke, I really talked about tweaks to our current Sherman Act and Clayton Act, not fundamental reform. I think Diana talked a little bit about concern with some of the industry-specific legislative proposals out there. My sense is, and Congress has done this before, it did it when it was unhappy with court interpretations of the Americans with Disabilities Act and amended the ADA in 2008 to direct the courts to a different interpretation of the ADA. The concerns with timeliness claims involving fair pay for women led to the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Again, Congress, I think it thought at the time, reinstating its original intent. Doesn't matter if there was reinstating or restating or stating anew, it had the right to do that. I do think there are some changes that can be made that would allow us to deal with some of the problems on the M&A side, the Clayton Act, and some of the behavior by dominant firms that seem to be entrenching their position without basically radically reforming antitrust law as it served us well today.
Yeah, I'd just like to make a couple of comments about the role of economics as an economist in antitrust. It's a big role, and it really took off, I think, as Judge Ginsburg has very accurately conveyed, really took off in the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, economists are they love data, and the easiest data to get is always price data, right? Much harder to get data on quality and innovation and all these sort of, you know, non-price effects. And so part of the legacy of the consumer welfare standard and the concerns we have with it now go all the way back to some of the initial interventions by economists in providing support to antitrust lawyers in the government and in private enforcement for to prove their case. And economics has sort of been on fire since then, but it has not been through a very balanced array of tools and methodologies. And the concern that we have now is not that economics shouldn't play a role, it should continue to play a role. There's a lot of innovative thinking out there. But the standard has been interpreted so narrowly, even with the support provided by economics, that we've reached a point in the economy where we're seeing very high levels of concentration. We actually have hard evidence of declining competition and the role of antitrust enforcement in that. So I think part of moving forward is to perhaps rebalance the role of economics and law. Economics has sort of taken over. I would even use the term hijacked the process, which is really not what you want. You want a much more balanced contribution of law and economics, and frankly, business disciplines and institutional expertise in how we go about enforcing the antitrust laws. And I think the lead-in to the legislative reform debate is really just that. For example, Senator Klobuchar's bills, which are represent constructive, comprehensive reforms, not targeted, company-specific or sector-specific bills, do things like shifting the burden. The burden is too high on the plaintiff, the private plaintiffs and the government plaintiffs. It's too high. That burden needs to be shifted to defendants to justify their deals. For example, on the merger front, the standards of proof are too high. Proving that a small nascent competitor would have entered a market but for an acquisition, that is almost impossible to make in many cases. But look at all the acquisitions of nascent competitors we've seen by the digital ecosystems. So I think comprehensive reform, constructive reform, would usefully implement burden shifting, lightening the standards of proof on plaintiffs, so that we can get to a point where we have more effective antitrust enforcement.
Francois?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Doug, to mention the Intel case. I think it is an interesting case because the court in that ruling said that the commission should take into consideration the position of a dominant company when it brings evidence that its conduct does not harm the market. And I think it was a victory for Intel, a big victory. I have a remark about the issue raised by Diana Ross, which looks interesting to me, and I'd like to understand in the European American view. You mentioned that the public interest standard, and I'd like to understand what it could represent if shifting to such a standard was possible or made.
Great. So one question I have for the panel. Sold the program with the notion that there's a lot going on right now in the antitrust space by regulators and Congress, maybe in the courts, and there are both changes have been occurring and changes are coming. And to the extent that's true, are these changes and the development we're seeing, is this being driven by new thinking or old ideas that have become new again? Or is it really being driven by changes in technology? We're a long ways from Standard Oil and breaking up the oil companies. We now have big tech, big pharma, these massive healthcare conglomerates, cryptocurrency. Is it just the new markets that are driving new thoughts about antitrust? Is it just old thinking, or is it something else, or a combination of those?
Okay, thanks. I predictably, I think it's a little bit of everything you raised. I do think that that some of the high-tech dominant firms are benefiting from long-standing economic principles, network effects, tipping points that that make them more powerful. Those concepts existed, but in a high-tech driven society, they may be more prevalent. I do think some of the calls for reform do represent, as Diana was saying earlier, a sense that we are not providing economic justice to lower income people the way they deserve, and that antitrust has a role in promoting a competitive economy, an economy that delivers high quality, low cost goods, and that more can be done than is being now. There is, I think, in the progressive movement, we haven't really talked about this as much, this sense that there are these other values that need to be reflected in public policy decisions, racial equality, those sorts of things. And as I tried to say in my remarks, I think those are legitimate public policy things. Judge Ginsburg talked about the notion of is job loss an appropriate concern of antitrust. I cannot imagine the two of us in the jobs we were privileged to share a little bit apart being in a position deciding we should challenge this merger because it's going to lose 400 jobs in my home state of Wisconsin and pick up 250 jobs in the state of Texas. I mean, that's not a role for an antitrust enforcer. It's not a role for a federal judge. There may be public policy concerns in Europe, as Francois knows well, does require some adjustment pay where you have a job loss thing. That's a public policy issue. Some people in this room might not agree that those costs ought to be borne by a buyer that puts a bunch of people out of work, give people a year severance or whatever. But that is a judgment that Congress could make. It is not a judgment Macon or Doug or I, as head of the antitrust division, think is a responsibility that is appropriately given to us.
Judge?
I'll pass. I think Diana had a question from
Diana. I just want to add to what Bill has very, what he's clearly articulated. Antitrust is law enforcement, right? It's about deterrence and it's about remedy. And it, as a tool, a mechanism of law enforcement, antitrust by design cannot solve every problem raised in the economy. Take the tech platforms, for example. Yes, there are some genuine competition problems in there, self-preferencing, algorithmic collusion, but privacy issues, for example, are hard to reach under antitrust, a law enforcement process. Software addiction problems, those are hard problems to reach with antitrust. So I go back to the original my original premise, which is declining competition is a public policy problem and requires that we look at all the available tools. And I would assert strongly that in the United States we have not done that. We have not done that. Using the antitrust process to quasi-regulate big tech is not an efficient use of antitrust. As law enforcement, it is a much, without a doubt, we have to rein in the market power of big tech. There are, those business ecosystems are chock full of economic anomalies that give rise to market power. But sector regulation is probably the better policy tool. It's probably more effective and more efficient at getting at those kinds of problems as opposed to using antitrust.
Francois, did you?
Well, thank you. Well, I'm not qualified to talk about, I mean, the U.S. situation. I would say that from my point of view, we are all looking for a balance. I mean, it's a matter of balance between what we said. I mean, preserve innovation, free economy, free market, innovation, Bill Baer mentioned distribution of wealth and economic justice. I mean, we cannot ignore the possible effects on some behavior, especially what we check a lot in Europe, which is the issue of possible competitors which do not exist but who may exist and who have to have a possible outcome.
Great, thanks. So we have a question from the audience, and we have probably time for a couple of questions if anyone else wants to line up to ask one.
Sure. So I guess two questions. One to Francois. How does France or the EU handle this issue about consumer welfare? Is that something that's directly addressed that must be met with the tests that are there, or is that just one of several factors? And then my second question is I'd love for the judge to respond to Diana's last comment, whether you feel that there are problems with big tech that could be handled by things other than antitrust, or if it can't be handled by antitrust, there's not a problem.
Your question was the way we deal with what?
Yes, so the consumer welfare standard, is that a requirement that must be met to find, an antitrust violation?
You mean the point of view of consumers or
yes.
The interests of the consumers?
So with the American system of requiring, you know, establishing economic harm for consumers before you find a violation, or is it simply harm to competitors is enough?
Well, I don't think we work the same way. I mean, the interests of consumers is an important thing, for sure. I mean, consumers' welfare. In many cases, we focus on the issue of competition itself. You see, I just won a case before the Supreme Court. It is about the merger of two French TV networks, and the French Supreme Court, the Conseil d'État, focuses really on the issue of competition itself, the relationship. The position of competitors on the market. I don't think we really focused on the issue of consumers. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Do you need the question repeated, Judge?
The question was, I think, whether I thought sectoral regulation was appropriate for the big tech firms. There are issues that arise, such as Diana mentioned, privacy, because consumer data is involved in what these firms trade in. And we need a privacy law, I think, at the national level. Right now, every firm in the United States that deals of any scale conforms itself to the GDPR, the European General Directive on Privacy Regulation. And if they happen to be in California or one or two or three other states, to their state law. But a patchwork of 50 state laws here, in addition to the GDPR, is going to be a nightmare for compliance and a huge disincentive, a barrier for small firms and new entrants. Regulation inherently favors incumbents, but it needn't do so excessively. So but even that regulation shouldn't be sectoral, it should be economy-wide. There's no reason for it to be specific to a particular sector or companies. As for a new sectoral regulator, if you will, for digital markets, I think that's probably not a good idea. I gave a response on BBC television last week to Chairman Coscelli's presentation on their digital markets unit, which he has set up but is awaiting legislative additional powers from the Parliament, which are not yet forthcoming, but will be. And I think that is probably not a good idea. The norms that are applicable are really norms of general application.
Great, thank you. I think we have two people in line for questions. That's probably all we'll have time for. So please.
Thank you, Judge. I think the name of this panel is Antitrust Revolution, or the title of it, with a question mark.
And that was so just to draw you in, actually.
Yes, at the
beginning. That's all about marketing.
I wanted to ask a question. I mean, Diana pointed out that antitrust enforcement is a law enforcement matter. Bill was pretty critical of the last administration when it came to a number of antitrust matters because some of the decisions were driven by the fifth floor of the department. How does that criticism of a political enforcement of Department of Justice antitrust cases square with the decision to have antitrust policy and coordination and by inference, enforcement coordinated and run out of the White House, as we're seeing with this administration? And I ask that sincerely. Thank you.
I'm glad to take that on. It's okay. You're talking about the Biden-Harris executive order that asks the entire executive branch and the independent regulatory agencies to do a better job of taking competition principles into effect in making decisions. I think this White House is going out of its way, and certainly this Attorney General, Merrick Garland, to make sure that that general policy guidance, which is the prerogative of the president, of the executive, to say, here's how we want to coordinate policy, but we're not going to dictate individual enforcement decisions, that's a pretty bright line that I've been in government three times. That's existed under Republican and Democratic presidents. So I do think what this executive order is attempting to do, and it's going to require a lot of discipline to do it, is to recognize that so many issues of competition that affect us as consumers are actually handled outside the FTC and outside the antitrust division of the Justice Department, whether it be DOT or Ag or labor or CFTC, you name it. There are DOD procurement. There are many issues. And so the notion is, let's get those issues of competition front and center when decisions are made, when regs are issued. And I think that's the focus of that executive order, and I applaud it.
The executive order had 72 specific recommendations, some of which I think would be inimical to competition, but others of which are innocuous, or in one case, it was something that the previous administration recommended, they can't get the FDA to do it. You know, as President Eisenhower said, I don't get it, I issue an order and nothing happens. So, but Bill's correct that so many competition issues arise in other agencies. I see them in my court. The SEC is an example, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, it's just all over the lot. Some, by statute, are supposed to take account of competition, but they rarely do, or if they do so, it's amateur night.
Yep, I would just add that the executive order really is the, it takes the whole of government approach, and this is part of the toolkit gestalt around competition policy, and antitrust enforcement is part of it. But there are other tools that can be leveraged and coordinated across government and agencies to really support good solutions to what I've now said several times is a public policy problem. And that means antitrust and regulation working together. You know, absolutely we should continue enforcing the antitrust laws against every sector and in every area of the law, including digital tech. But there are a lot of sectors where we see regulation and antitrust working together in a complementary way. I'm a former federal regulator myself and did a lot of work with antitrust agencies when I was at a regulatory commission. So I think that is the spirit of the executive order.
I apologize to our last questioner. I've been told we have people coming in for the next program already. So thank you very much to our panel. This was really terrific.